Good morning, good morning, and good morning to you too. Welcome to Law of the Land, and I am Gloria J. Brown Marshall, coming to you another day, as we always say, to try to get it right, another chance. We woke up this morning, so that gives us one more opportunity to do the things we feel that we in our hearts are meant to do, and to help our families, our community, our country, the world, be a little better. One step at a time, within our wingspan, we can do right. We can do justice, and we're here to empower, inspire, inform, and help you. Well, and then helps you help everybody else just by example. If they see you doing it, they too could be strong. And that's what we need at this time. This is a tough year and we're going into it, but just think about WBAI has been training our listeners all of this time with the information needed for us to stand strong. Just think of all that's been given over these many decades in our show alone to inform you and empower you. That's what makes me really just excited, to know that I'm not sure who might catch the fire. That's what I say in my classes. Who's going to catch the fire? I don't know. But I know that if I don't put it out there, it's not there to be caught. So that's why I do what I do. And today we're going to talk about book bans. And you've heard a lot about it, or maybe not. There's a reference here and there of what's going on, and we want to go into a deeper dive on what it means to ban a book. What does that mean? And why is it happening right now? This is not the first time. This ebbs and flows. It really does. This has been going on and off over many years, and I'll tell you, over 100 years, maybe 150. You know, we can start thinking about all the way back to Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin, because even then, that was a trigger for many people around the slavery issue, and what some people had said for some places emboldened people from the knowledge of the cruelty of slavery in that book to make them take a stand against enslavement in this country. And because it had that power, then on the other side, there were those who would not allow the book to be read, to be even in that state. I want you to think about their newspapers like the Chicago Defender that used to be carried by the Pullman porters. Those were the black men who worked on the railroads, who were able to travel through the different states, take information, news from the black newspapers down south. And also, because they could take the newspapers down south, they could take books down south from the north. But they had to hide them because the books were banned in the south. They did not want people in the south to be inspired, empowered. I mean, let's think a little even deeper, and I'm not going to go too deep with this one, but I just want to give you an idea of this. Juneteenth. It's a national holiday now in June, and it's called Juneteenth because it was around June 19th, June 15th. They're not sure, later June, when word of the Emancipation Proclamation that had been signed by President Abraham Lincoln finally reached Texas, because it had been banned. The information had been banned from reaching Texas. It was in the newspapers, but it was not allowed to be in the newspapers in Texas, or in any of those states that had seceded from the Union and were Confederate states still under Confederate stronghold. It wasn't until the Union forces finally broke through to the Deep South that the Emancipation Proclamation that stated by law that all of those enslaved people were free, that had been put in place years ago, finally reached those people in the Deep South. The war technically was over because the surrender of the South had already taken place with General Lee. And yet it was not known until the Emancipation Proclamation reached Texas in June of 1865. I want us to understand that unfortunately, information being banned is not something that's new, but it does have the same visceral effect. There are certain people who don't want readers to know. As we know, in during the time period of enslavement and during the time period where women were oppressed, that women were not taught to read, and that was a form of banning. You don't get to know what's inside of the book. You don't get to know what's put in a newspaper, what's printed. You don't get to be able to make ideas of your own and decisions of your own based on the most valuable and available information. You are being kept from it, intentionally made ignorant, so that you cannot see beyond whatever the world is that's being created by those people in positions of power to do such a ban. I want us to think about all of that when we realize this conservative wave that's washed over this nation over the last, in deep ways, over the last 7 to 10 years, didn't just start. We had waves of those people who thought they were the Tea Party and represented what they thought was the Tea Party people who threw the tea overboard during the precursor to the Revolutionary War. I don't think they got that right, but that's what they call themselves. We had people up to this point who were part of conservatives who had taken over school boards, and they took over the school boards little by little, incrementally, to control the local political environment of small towns and then larger places. It was a concerted effort. Brilliant effort. Brilliant. I like to give credit where credit is due, and that was a brilliant political strategy that was put in place over 50 years ago and incrementally built so they could have the foundation of the school boards and then rise from there into these different political positions. And so now we have conservative judges, we have conservative members of Congress, we have these conservative parties, and conservatism is not the issue here. One can be so-called progressive, liberal, conservative, independent. That's not the point. The point is the use of that power was with the viewpoint of crushing other people and maintaining a system where their voice was the only voice. Now, some might say from the other side, well, that's what the liberals did. We had to hear from them, and now we want to create the world based on how we see it, how we think the world should be. And I have to push back on that by saying, if the world is based on Donald Trump and his value system, we heard when he first ran for president of the United States how he would cheat his workers, that he would have union-based workers come in and build his casinos and then file for bankruptcy so he wouldn't have to pay them. We heard this. We heard later on his own voice saying how he grabbed women and, you know, would do these things of assault, considered assault under law, to them, but he thought he could do it because of when you're famous, you can get around and away with all these things. We then had these cases with, you know, these porn star. We've had him cheating on his wife again and again. Men cheat on their wives. Women cheat on their husbands. Partners cheat on partners, girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever. The point is the value system of the person who's going to be the voice. This is the one you want as the voice. And unfortunately, all of us as human beings are weak, and we do make mistakes. But when the mistake becomes glorified, when you hear people from the evangelicals on saying, oh, he's a broken pot, so the cracks that we see are what God wanted. There's even a video showing that God made him so that he could be here for this moment in time. What is happening in this moment of time, this particular time in the country, that is so terrorized, frightened, and made into ruffians at their very heart? a sense of desperation that someone so corrupt and crooked could represent their value systems. And I know people are, you know, because we get listeners from all over, and it's like now they're erupting in their living room and yelling back at the radio, and I get that. But I really don't get how this person represents a value system that would allow the banning of books, the burning of books, in what people claim they want, which is a democracy. They want to be able to vote their conservatives into office and no one else. They want to be able to take over their community and their country in a way in which no one can think past their ideas that they've put out there. The library was my sanctuary growing up, and I will continue to protect it. I will continue to speak out for young people to have books on the library where they can walk down the aisle and just look up, and maybe it's the color of the cover. Maybe it's the image on it. Maybe it's the title, whatever it is. By happenstance, they reach up and take that book off of the shelf and begin to read it. Yes, there's a children's section that should be appropriate for children, but also different children are at different stages and need different types of information. So we're going to be talking about the cases that are the foundation for where we are with book banning, because you would think by what we're reading and hearing and seeing that there are no legal cases around book banning. There are several, and we're going to discuss them. And actually, the precedent, the pre-existing foundation, says that what is being done is actually against the law, against First Amendment rights. We're going to be here with the General Counsel of the Authors Guild. The Authors Guild is an amazing organization, membership organization, with people who are writers in every different degree of their career in writing, whether or not they're thinking about being a writer, or written books, they've gotten books. And for full disclosure, I'm a member of the Authors Guild, and the General Counsel will be with us after this musical break to discuss book banning, the law behind it, and especially what it is and how it impacts readers, writers, and our civil liberties. And what we want you to know about today is the subject of book bans. And I'm here with Cheryl Davis, General Counsel of Authors Guild. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning, Gloria. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for joining me. And Cheryl Davis is General Counsel of the Authors Guild, and she oversees the organization's legal affairs, including its in-house corporate affairs. And you manage so much, and your background is so extensive around this issue of not just the banning of books, but how the intellectual property, which we know as books, is protected and used. And in this particular instance, when we're talking about book banning, how has this affected the membership of the Authors Guild?
Well, it certainly affected the membership, because denying people access to books denies them access to what an author creates. And our recent author income survey has showed that what the author's incomes are, and they are lower than minimum wage at this point. But what it does was limiting the access to books limited the author's ability to support themselves and to get their voices out there. And the getting the voices out there is one of the key elements and the key missions of the Authors Guild, because we are big supporters of free speech. And also, when we talk about authors, yes, but we cannot forget the freedom to read that is key to our democracy, the ability to be able to read and exchange ideas on topics.
And tell us, how did the Authors Guild come to be?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
How did the authors, what is the background? How was it created? The Authors Guild is an organization. It's really interesting when you think about a guild as a union. And I guess most people might think of the pipe fitters union or any other union of flight attendants. But now we are discussing a union for writers.
Well, the Authors Guild is not like the Writers Guild in that we're not technically a union. Unions are really for employees. And the Authors Guild, which was founded as the Authors League back in 1912, the Authors Guild is an association. It's a professional association, a trade association of professional writers. And whereas employees need to, they cannot hold on to their copyright, and the employer owns the copyright. Well, employers in the writing industry are work made for hire basis. For example, in film and TV, the Writers Guild is a union because they can negotiate collective terms. We, as the Authors Guild, cannot negotiate collective terms. What we do is we promote education. We help lobby for particular terms and particular issues for authors as a whole. And for our members, we provide certain additional services. For example, there are certain member benefits and member resources are only available to members. But our lobbying work is really for the benefit of all authors.
And so 1912, even going back to that, this idea that there would be the need for this collective, for writers to come together because their voices were stronger in an organization than it would be individually. And even then, the collective, the idea of writers benefiting from, as you said, a protection, a shield of being part of this guild. And so over this time, in what ways has the Authors Guild actually benefited writers?
Oh, my goodness. For one thing, for our members, we review their contracts and provide legal services. We answer legal questions on topics. We also provide educational webinars for authors as a whole. As I mentioned, we do lobbying efforts. And also, for example, in the book banning area, we come out with statements. And most recently, we, along with other freedom to read and free speech organizations, have filed lawsuits against particular laws that would limit people's ability to access the books of certain authors. So there's...
Now, let's discuss some of those lawsuits. So what was the first one that was actually filed that included the Authors Guild?
The lawsuit, most recently, we had one in the state of Arkansas, which there was a law passed that would limit the ability of minors to access certain books. And this also included in public locations, such as in public libraries or in bookstores, which means that if a certain book, if a book that was deemed to be unsuitable for, say, a five-year-old would be in a bookstore, it would have to be segregated into a certain area in which a five-year-old would not be able to access it. So if you're an adult and you have your five-year-old with you, there would be areas of the bookstore that you cannot even go into with your five-year-old because they'd have access to this kind of book. We realized that this was vastly overreaching in terms of the law, and that is one of the laws that we were a plaintiff in bringing a lawsuit against. And that law has been preliminarily enjoined, which means it's not being enforced right now in Arkansas. Matters are proceeding in discovery, which means that they're getting additional information is being exchanged. And a trial date has been set for October of this year.
And so the fact that a trial date has been set is not going to settle, that this law is one in which money will be spent defending it on both sides, because there's a belief that certain books should be segregated away from whatever group they believe is not competent enough to read it, or they believe it's going to be dangerous for them. I want us to even on that note, for that particular legal case, go back and discuss a few of these precedents that are in place. And I'm going to just put them out there, and most people don't know about Island Trees Union Free School versus PICO. And this is a 1982 case that went to or was well had a imprint with the Supreme Court. and a local school board believed that certain books were anti-American, anti-Christian, anti-Semitic, and then one point it was quoted just plain filthy, and mm-hmm. decided that these books, Slaughterhouse Five and others, were not to be in their school library. Now, this is a high school and junior high school case. What's interesting about this, Cheryl, and this is what something I want to get your viewpoint on. One, we know that a library means that the book is not required reading. It's just on the shelf available to be read. When you're bringing these cases, and it's with the bookstore where you have tens of thousands of books there and a book is on the shelf, what's the argument that's being made that from the other side that this book should not be on the shelf?
The argument when you're dealing with things like arguments that children, that students should not get access to certain books, essentially they're arguing that there should be a limitation on what is available to minors. And there are certain laws on what with the principle that something can be harmful to a minor. And one thing that they are often overreaching in is they're affecting the free rights and the liberties of adults when they come up with certain laws. So there's certainly, as it said, in this Arkansas case, the court recognized that the law itself was massively overbroad. You're not dealing simply with, in that case, a school library where, yes, a school system does have the right to maintain an additional authority over what books are available in their school libraries. Here, the law was also talking about public libraries and bookstores.
But I guess I'm putting you in a corner to have to argue the other side. I'm trying to figure out why, for example, a school library. And in a school library, we're talking about a library where the ideas in the book are among books, tens of thousands of books that are on the shelves, perhaps. Mm-hmm. To dislike the idea in the book, in a case that we have from 1982, the Island Trees Union Free School case, that actually says that a local school board cannot remove books based on ideas. Why is it that people are continuing, I shouldn't say people, but the leaders of these groups that are opposing books, that are banning books, how is it that they're ignoring what is the precedent or the legal standard that we are supposed to be using?
Well, a number of these bills try to do is they try to draw in language from criminal bills like child pornography and what is harmful to minors, and even some case obscenity laws. They will draw in and they will cherry pick certain terms from these laws. But what they neglect to do is to apply things such as the Miller test in obscenity, where you're not supposed to just say something is obscene. You have to say that it violates, for example, it has no literary, artistic, or public or scientific value to it. And there are tests that one needs to be able to go through to show that something is obscene, or if something is, say, pornographic, or something is harmful to a minor. And what a number of these cases do is they will pick out certain language, but they will neglect to include the test, the balancing that must be done in order to rule that something is, say, obscene or pornographic or harmful to a minor. And that is they present these laws as, oh, children and minors, we must protect them. But the thing is, you cannot protect them so much to the point where you are stifling them and where you are limiting their own freedoms. And that's where they kind of fail to draw the line.
And the court, though, should know what the precedent is. Why aren't these cases being dismissed? This is really a question I have, and of course neither one of us can answer based on perhaps the conservative background of these judges. But for example, in going to Arkansas again, there's already precedent there in Counts versus Cedarville School District from a 2003 federal case that indicated when parents wanted to ban Harry Potter from the library, Harry Potter from the school's book curriculum, because they said it dealt with witchcraft.
Yes.
And even then, it was found to be impermissible to restrict access to books based on the ideas expressed in them, that it violated the First Amendment. And yet, we still have these laws being created in the face of what is precedent that says they cannot do it. So what you're saying is they're going around this precedent by saying that these are crimes. This isn't about civil law. This is about criminal law.
In some cases, yes. And in some cases, people are proposing laws that would limit the protections that, say, librarians and school teachers have from presenting certain books to children. There are certain laws in the criminal laws that limit their liability if they have, for example, present a certain type of book to a child unknowingly, or if the book is even perceived to be a wrongful. But there are laws that are trying to take away these sorts of protections to try to terrify people. I think a fair amount of these laws is to have an interim effect and to have the impact of discouraging teachers and librarians from even buying these books, from bookstores, from even having these books generally available, which is one of the biggest concerns we have, is that it eliminates the ability for anybody to get, may eliminate the ability of anybody to get access to certain books.
So go ahead, please.
And I was going to say that the Arkansas court even addressed the overarching nature of this bill and said that they felt that the lack of clarity was a matter of design, and that it would then allow people to interpret the bill as they choose rather than perhaps in a constitutional manner.
And so Florida,
people are trying to pick and speak. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Florida, we have the dictionary ban. We have books by James Patterson, who is the most prolific, they're saying now, and probably the wealthiest of the authors. my concern is when the dictionary is banned, I'm thinking, okay, there are words in the dictionary that certain people are not, if they find that word in the dictionary, would find offensive. The cherry picking here is also to the point of having a disparate effect that's deeper and wounding more women of color as well as those people who are gay or have issues in their books that deal with sexual orientation. But even that's already been addressed, because the Sund, S-U-N-D, versus City of Wichita Falls, Texas case of 2000, where the book Heather Has Two Mommies and Daddy's Roommate was found also to be protected. And the district court said they would not enforce the resolution of parents that said that the book was wrong, and they had a system where if 300 signatures of people with library cards asked for the removal of the book, they would be removed. And so they said, well, this is tantamount to a heckler's veto. So if the heckler in the group says, no, we don't like that, then it's taken off the stage. And so if these 300 people who have library cards could say, no, we don't want that book in the library, it could be removed based on the ideas in the book. So once again, even when it comes to the topic areas of sexual orientation or different love relationships, even those were protected by precedent. And so once again, we're seeing this very disproportionate effect of book bans on writers of color. My book, I actually was in Florida and was in one of the local libraries looking for my book. And I saw two of them, but I didn't see the third. And the more recent one, She Took Justice, was not there. And I asked about it, and the librarians kind of just looked at each other because they seemed afraid. And this idea of not only do we have this disproportionate effect on people of color and other people who are writing about very necessary topics that have been outside of, you know, the general view and readership. Now the librarians are being threatened if they attempt to bring these books in, because these books have to be bought and then, you know, decisions made for bringing them into the library. I think most people think the books fall out of the sky and end up on the shelf, but there's actually a process for this. And librarians are being intimidated out of having certain books on the shelf. Have you heard about this, like, from your membership at Authors Guild?
Well, yes, we certainly are aware of members like you who have had their books banned. There have been members and authors that we know of who have been unable to, say, go into schools and do readings of their books because of their sexuality or their sexual identity. There have been people who have lost, as I said before, a fair amount of income because not only are their books being bought, they're not able to get the sort of speaking engagements because people are afraid. Even when we're talking about laws, but they're also, and I love the phrase, the heckler's veto. I've always been a big supporter of that phrase because these regulations, these school board regulations, essentially allow people to just file complaints. And out of fear, many books are often just removed from the shelves without even going through the necessary internal process. And we work with the National Coalition Against Censorship to write letters to these schools that are removing books simply because, say, one, not even necessarily parent, one person objects to this. I think the Washington Post last year had an article on how the majority of these school book removals are based upon the complaints of about 11 people. And in Florida, they think there are two people who are filing about over 700 objections to books. And you really cannot allow these individuals to be able to decide what everyone else has to read. There's already a structure set up where if you're a parent, you can control what your individual child may have access to. That doesn't mean that you have the right to control what everybody's child has the access to. And that's what we're objecting to.
And the objections that you, as general counsel of the Authors Guild, as well as PEN America, and for full disclosure, I am a member of PEN America, is another group that has filed lawsuits, and their lawsuit is actually one that's focused on Escambia County in Florida. And the Escambia County situation seems to be just one of delirium, where this is one of the places. Florida has been the epicenter, and DeSantis, who's now stepping back a little bit from his staunch opposition, maybe because he's no longer trying to curry the votes of people from the far conservative right. But this banning of the dictionary, banning of so many different books that the list had thousands of books on it. And once again, we're seeing it appears that there is this concerted group that is just filing these complaints. And many of the libraries, especially if you think about a small town where everyone knows almost everyone, and this complaint comes in, and people are capitulating rather than having to fight these groups because it's just the sense of terrorism around the country that, you know, there are those with guns and will go to their homes. And it's just really a horrible thing for a librarian who's unprepared for any of this to have to go through in order to just defend their book and then ending up losing their jobs. There are librarians who are being fired just because they didn't capitulate fast enough to the demands of people who may or may not even live there, who are saying that certain books should be taken off of the shelf, and especially the anti-critical race theory wave that's come through the country that's affected many books on slavery. And now we're seeing the argument that if the book has the word black in it, and mine does, she took justice, the black woman law and power, and that may be why it's not going to be on the shelf when my other two books are on the shelf. So what is the overarching plan of the Authors Guild? I know you don't want to give away all the secrets, but I really like to give my listeners homework. What can they do in this situation? Because it seems like we have the law, we have the precedent that says, no, you cannot do these things, and yet it's being done.
because, as I said before, it's they're trying to get around the current law, but also they're getting political capital out of this. They're getting press out of this. I mean, you go back to Youngkin, when Governor Youngkin was elected, on the grounds of like, oh, our parents need to be more active in the schools, and there are certain things that's happening in the schools that we need to protect the kids. And other politicians saw this, including there was a case in Virginia Beach in which graphic novel Genderqueer, a local politician, as a part of his campaign, he actually filed a petition to ask the court to declare the Genderqueer and another novel as obscene for unrestricted viewing by minors, which, Gloria, is not even a legal standard. But he went into the court, asked them to declare that these books were obscene for unrestricted viewing by minors. And he had a list of about 20-some-odd other books. But he said that if this tactic works, these are other books that we're then going to try to remove from bookstores, because he filed actually against Barnes & Noble. So we don't want Barnes & Noble to allow minors to have access to these books. So that was used as a political tactic. Fortunately, the court refused to do so. But unfortunately, this politician also said that, well, what we can do is make them have to rate these books so parents know if its book is sexually explicit or whatever. And actually, that's what the Texas law that we brought a lawsuit against was, into requiring not just the state, actually, but requiring booksellers, like publishers, and anybody who wants to sell a book in the state to a school in the state of Texas would have to rank their books either sexually explicit or sexually relevant. And the court has preliminarily enjoined that law as well. So we're waiting to proceed with that lawsuit and see ultimately if the court decides to strike the law down entirely. But so that is what people can do is, one, you need to be aware of what's going on in your local area. And one of the things that one of the groups we belong to is called Unite Against Book Bans. And they have individual members in which that can tell you, okay, here are particular, say, school boards that are meeting, or here are particular laws that may be being passed that you should write in opposition to. And the Authors Guild has a toolkit, for example, that can set out templates to say if you want to write objecting to a particular book bill. People can run for office. Not even just run for main office, but just be on your book board. Read books for your library. We are a part of the coalition of Unite Against Book Bans out there. We are active ourselves. There are also the federal government. Last year, the Biden administration announced the creation of an anti-book ban coordinator. And there is now coordinator and the Department of Education. What they are doing is they are looking to school systems where students are being discriminated against or feel they're being discriminated against because they're not able to access books reflecting their race or their gender or their sexuality. And if they feel discriminated against, if this is negatively impacting their education, the Department of Education and we'll accept complaints on these topics. And they need to be affecting students. But people can be aware of if they're their own child or if they're aware of a student who says, I don't feel like I can use the school library anymore because books that reflect my experience are no longer there. That may be the subject of a complaint that can be made to the Department of Education. So there are a variety of ways people can speak out as individuals in their local communities. When school board meetings have meetings, they're often publicly announced, and there are people, sometimes we will ask authors to attend these meetings, and we've seen videos of people speaking out against the mischaracterization of their books, because more often than not, again, back to the cherry picking, Gloria, people will cherry pick from certain words and certain images and say, oh, this book is obscene and it shouldn't be in our school system. And what the author and other individuals can do is set it in context and say, you're taking one image or one phrase out of this book. What this book is actually about, you say, for example, how
young people can avoid being sexually trafficked, how they can try to avoid, how do they handle it when they're sexually assaulted or when they're discriminated against because of their race. What sorts of learning and tools can we provide them to be able to do this? And this book is one of those things. And there are things that kids need access to be able to learn about that, these situations, to be able to confront and handle them later on. So, yes, people can reach out and speak in their local school systems. They can sign on to petitions against particular laws as they become aware of these laws. And it's one of the things we are doing is we reach out to our members, and we're trying to increase our membership and our reach to be able to say that things like, well, in Texas, say, there was a situation where books were removed from the library, and the court said, you must put these books back on the library shelves pending this lawsuit. And the local county had decided, you know what, let's have a meeting and decide if we want to continue to have our library open if we're going to have to put these books back. And we've reached out to local members in that area, in that Llano County, to say that, please, they're threatening to close the library. Please reach out. Please do something. So when we become aware of these kinds of things in local areas, we will reach out to members and say, like, okay, here's something that is going on in your area. Here's a way you can access who your representative is. Here's a template of a letter you can send, or if we may have a letter that we're circulating that you can sign on to, saying we object to this kind of thing. So, and as I said, we've got toolkits. NCAC has a toolkit also that can help people deal with what's going on in their school libraries and their school systems. So there is, believe me, there are ways that you as an individual can help. There are things that you as an individual can do. And the Authors Guild wants to help you be able to help you be able to do that.
And I want it to be understood that this rewriting of history, and it could be people have their own take on history, but this sense of, for example, when enslavement was seen as a work project that was beneficial to those people enslaved. I mean, these ideas we look at and we say, this is so insulting. But then when you think of a child learning about American history, where slavery was, and I remember in my social studies book, was perhaps one page out of the entire book. And now that the world has been expanded, in which books that had been written about slavery were read by certain communities but not available to others, we're going back to this time where people want to create an image for young people's minds that is untrue, in which those people, especially people of color, women, and others, who were depicted in a certain way to appease the sensitivities of those people who were creating a world of falsity and myth, are afraid that our young people will then have a fuller version of the country, are now in positions to undermine the inclusion of that information, not just in the school curriculum, in the library, and you're saying in the bookstore. This has gone to the point of the Bible itself. The Bible is being banned in many places. And just to understand, and the cyclical way this is working, back in the 1920s, there was a ban on, or thought to be an attempt to ban the Bible. And even then, that was in California, in the case in which the court in California, the state court, said, no, you cannot ban this, the ideas within the book. Whether or not in the Bible, you know, they're smoting people every day. You want to talk about a lot of bad things happening. It's like worse than a James Patterson novel. But what really gets me about it is these people are trying to ban ideas. And the sense that if you read this, you may think a certain way. And I understand this sensitivity for generations of those who have depicted this country in a very narrow sense that made them the hero. And now that more information can be learned by our young people, that this was not a heroic endeavor in many instances. This land was taken from Native Americans. Kidnapped people were forced by threat of death to work on this land over generation after generation. The true history of America is something that people are and have trouble with and should be ashamed by. But my concern is the power they seem to continue to have as good people do nothing. And the yes. Authors Guild templates that you've said, and it's on the Authors Guild, and that's authorsguild.org. I just want to yes. make sure everybody has the website. They're able to know you've been, you know, if you knew, what would you do? Now you know, what are you going to do? You can mm-hmm. go to the Authors Guild website. Give them more information about two big things they can do right now, because this is not just for the tri-state area. But even in the tri-state mm-hmm. area, we think of New York City, but there are very small school districts all within the tri-state area that mm-hmm. are wrestling with this issue. Librarians, what can the librarians do?
Oh, my goodness. Well, librarians, as you said, they are under attack, and we actually are working in coalitions with the ALA, the American Library Association, to be able to promote the rights of librarians to have these kinds of books. And, Gloria, there's actually a law been proposed in the state of Georgia that would undercut the ALA, because people are essentially, it's another way of attacking librarians, the people who have the professional expertise to be able to judge what sorts of books are suitable for what age groups. But in terms of protecting librarians, the ALA has local branches that one might want to reach out to. There's a Texas Library Association, Georgia Library Association, whatever, that may be able to let you know how to best help your local librarian. Are there people that you should be writing to on their behalf? Are there petitions that you should be signing on behalf specifically of librarians? I mean, we try to reach out and work with them in terms of, like, laws that also impact authors as well, because a number of times we're on the same side in these sorts of battles. So, yes, librarians do need to be protected. I have seen myself on social media, librarians will speak out on topics like saying we should be able to have X book because this is why it is good for children to be able to read about this. And somebody will comment underneath saying, you just want children to have porn. I mean, librarians are being demonized in this environment. And that's the kind of thing that one needs to object to and to be aware of. And to be aware of what's going on in your local community. If you hear that something is going on that, say there's a dispute over a book in your community, you may reach out to the library, the librarian, and ask them, what is it I can do to help?
I think this is an ongoing issue, and I hope that you will come back, Cheryl Davis, to speak with us again about this, to keep us abreast of the lawsuits that are going forward and mm-hmm. where they are and the outcomes. I think that it's needed for us. As I've said from the very beginning of this show, the library was my sanctuary growing up. Mm-hmm. It was the place where I feel so comfortable and at home, and whether or not that library is here or in other countries, the archives, that's the smell of the book on the shelf is something mm. that has been always an embracing sense for me of home, of a place where my mind can flourish. And what you're doing at the Authors Guild, we want to commend you. And if you would, please come back and tell us more.
I would love to, Gloria. I'm delighted to be here to speak to your audience.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with Cheryl Davis, General Counsel of Authors Guild. For those of you out there, please know the Authors Guild is a wonderful place for you to exchange ideas, to build that confidence, to write that great novel or nonfiction book. It's a wonderful place, authorsguild.org, and get those templates, the letters, what you need to empower yourself to help defend our libraries, defend the access to information, defend our books in this horrific time of book banning, books being burned. This is happening right here in this country. I want to give one announcement before I head out, and that one announcement that I hope you'll be able to join the 17th Annual National Black Writers Conference, March 20th to 23rd. Put that down on your calendar. Save the date, March 20th to the 23rd, the National Black Writers Conference that will be held at Medgar Evers College. That's part of the City University of New York, Go CUNY, in Brooklyn, the Medgar Evers College. So if you can, please arrive there and enjoy all that there is to be had. Register for this event and go online. Just put as a search terms, the National Black Writers Conference. The types of writers who are there, I couldn't believe the lineup. It's amazing. Thank you, Brenda Green. And I will be there as part of the ongoing events. So please, if you can, go see, listen, partake, be a part of the National Black Writers Conference. And this conference is a summit keynote that I will be a part of as a moderator. Is taking place on Friday, but I want you to be there for the entire conference. Once again, that's March 20th to 23rd. And for those of you who need more information, Unite Against Book Bans. Unite Against Book Bans is the entity that our guest Cheryl Davis spoke of, and you could join that Unite Against Book Bans. You can, if you are part of the library system, if you're a parent, if you care about books, if you too had the library as your sanctuary, if you too felt that that book transported you to other places, whether or not you were a young person or even today, the book is in trouble. Can you believe it? We're going to have to accept it. And then once we accept the book is in trouble, the book, whatever the book, be it a romance novel or a nonfiction book that's about travel, our books are in trouble. So please become a warrior, if you can, a weekend warrior on behalf of the book. This has been Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Thank you, Michael G. And I'll see you on the radio.